This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, July 6th, 2023, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from bookriot.com. Rebecca.
Hello.
After this show for the Patreon feed, we are recording. Well, you tell the people. I do enough of the explaining.
We are recording.
Tell them what we're recording.
The books of the year so far. So not our favorites, not our personal reading list, but the books that have been the stories of publishing, or, you know, the things people have talked about that have made some waves of 2023 so far. We're coming in each with a list, like a power ranked list of the top five. We have not seen each other's lists. We're going to see what happens. It's going to be a good time.
Was the list hard for you to make?
The first three or four just popped right off my head, and then deciding on the fifth one, or like between a couple of contenders for the fifth one and then some also-rans, was interesting. And as with most of the setups we give ourselves for bonus episodes, I reserve the right to change the order I've put them in until the very last minute.
Even on the fly, you can change. Yeah. I thought this was hard. And we've been doing the It book for first edition, which cross-promo opportunity here.
Yeah.
And even so, I thought it was hard. And I think part of it is you need a longer view for the books of the year. And so some of the stuff that just came out, I don't know how you evaluate that. But I also think it's been true that we kind of haven't had an It book of the year. I guess that's my hot take.
Yes, I agree.
That most people would agree on, but makes for a good conversation. If you like this kind of stuff, sign up for the Patreon or come listen to First Edition.
Or both.
You don't have to choose.
We're coming from a place of abundance in the middle of summer here.
So many ways of talking about the same thing.
Listen, they're here for this show. They want to hear us talk about some more stuff in some more ways.
On First Edition right now, the most recent episode is you and me, talking about the It books of July, of which there are many interesting candidates. There was no, I guess to spoil it a little bit, there was no lurking champion. There was no Muhammad Ali that you were going to have to knock out or worry about knocking out. So it made for a good discussion.
I'm going to have to listen to that because we recorded that, I think, when I was like 2 hours away from leaving for vacation, and it was just a fever dream, and I don't remember which one I selected as the winner at the end of the episode. So it'll be a surprise even to me.
Northwestern Guide to Rockhounding, which I thought was an odd choice. You picked off the board. You kind of ordered off menu.
Like to keep you on your toes. Weird. We got to keep it interesting. But, you know, I love a just lacuna of content creation that is like, right, that was, we recorded that 3 weeks ago. July was just a far off dream at that point. So I will have to listen and be re-surprised by the whole process.
Yeah. So First Edition, you can check that out. The Patreon, that will be, we're going to record it now, but it'll release next week. Just check out First Edition interviews, recommendations, readings. I've had people on to tell reading stories. It's going to be a little quieter over the next couple of months in terms of the feature pack. There will be episodes coming out, but I've got some ideas for the fall. So that's First Edition. I think that takes us to our first break. I've got a wild card to throw at you here.
Well, you know,
a second,
I love a wild
we'll come
card.
Back in just a second.
Today's episode is brought to you by Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle. Walk, Ride, Paddle is a captivating memoir of Senator Tim Kaine's physical journey through the Virginia wilderness, but it is also a unique and ultimately optimistic perspective on these pivotal moments in history, offering inspiration, wisdom, and hope. With immediacy and honesty, Kaine pulls back the curtain to reveal his inner thoughts during such monumental times. And Kaine's storytelling gift and wise observations offer a fascinating glimpse into the mind of a seasoned politician and outdoor enthusiast. Walk, Ride, Paddle is available everywhere audiobooks are sold on April 9th. It is narrated and written by Tim Kaine, Virginia senator and former Democratic vice presidential candidate. It's a compelling account of one man's journey across hundreds of miles of Virginia wilderness and a moving testament to the optimistic spirit of America. So make sure to check out Walk, Ride, Paddle by Tim Kaine. And thanks again to Harper Horizon, publisher of Walk, Ride, Paddle, for sponsoring this episode.
This episode is sponsored by The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy. Robbie and Trevor Cressmont have enough wealth to ensure they'll never be found guilty of any wrongdoing, even if everyone believes they're behind the deaths of their ex-girlfriends. Let us all take a collective angry sigh at that. Lauren O'Brien, the new girl at school, has a dark past of her own, and she's desperate for a fresh start. Except when she starts a relationship with Robbie, her chance is put in jeopardy. During what's meant to be their last weekend together, Lauren stumbles across evidence that might just implicate Robbie. And after a third death rocks the town, she must decide whether to end things with Robbie or risk becoming another cautionary tale. This is an edge-of-your-seat YA thriller that's perfect for fans of Karen McManus and Holly Jackson. Make sure you pick that up now wherever books are sold. And thank you once again to The One That Got Away with Murder by Trish Lundy for sponsoring today's show.
Today's episode is brought to you by Bloom Books. Taming Seven is an epic and unforgettable love story in the international best-selling and TikTok phenomenon The Boys of Tommen series from Chloe Walsh. So Tommen's cheekiest lad, Jared Gibbsy Gibson, has always been a comedian, but inside he is haunted by events of the past and he uses humor to cope, hiding his true self from the world. Then you have Claire Biggs, who is the epitome of sunshine. She's always loved Gibbsy, her brother's friend and her favorite neighbor. She also has always seen a side to him that no one else seems to notice, and she becomes determined to tame her wild-at-heart childhood best friend. So the Boys of Tommen series is an internationally best-selling YA romance series that has taken TikTok by storm. It's perfect for readers looking for new adult slash crossover romance, dual point of views, friends to lovers, marathon worthy TikTok books, and angsty tearjerkers. Taming Seven is published today, and it's the fifth book in the series, so make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Bloom Books for sponsoring this episode.
One of the things we've been doing for First Edition and for the Patreon episodes, and thank you so much for people that subscribed. I got some nice emails of people would like us to do IT books for historical months. Like, what if you did, you know, each one was like, and then this one 10 years ago or last year.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
It's kind of what we do for power rankings. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of books, Rebecca, and how to plumb the depths of the old content to see what else is interesting is a fun idea. But people like that. People like to hear about what the new books coming out are. I had this idea for an ongoing content piece for Book Riot from the very beginning, and I've never done it. And that often tells you something, right? At some point, you know, there's the someday maybe folder in OmniFocus.
And it's just, and it becomes a never folder.
Becomes a never folder. So maybe the best thing I can do with it is throw it at you right here to see what your thoughts are. Why haven't I done this? Is it a good or bad idea? And then get listeners to weigh in a little bit as well.
All right. I'm ready.
This reminds me, so it's related to the IT books thing, but kind of not really, because the IT books are new books coming out this. I'm thinking of something more like the hot list for a given month. What are the hot books this month? And what that really lets you do is get rid of the constraint of it has to be coming out this month. So it could be a paperback release, right? Maybe there's some reason you want a paperback release. It could be a reissue of some kind. It could be, and maybe you turn it over every month, but let's say I would have made Blood Meridian the IT book of July.
Interesting.
Right? I think we even talked about that on the show. But if you had sort of like a, you know, kind of a real time or maybe updated monthly or weekly, what are the 50 hot books right now? And Blood Meridian could pop up when Cormac McCarthy dies. Or I didn't put a link here, but I put it in somewhere else where you collect links, where Nimona, the graphic novel adaptation, hit Netflix, written by the great Andy Stevenson, and they tweeted, it sold out at Amazon. You can't buy the graphic novel. You also cannot buy it at Powell's, because I was going to buy it for my kids, because Ames read it on
it's
digital,
so
but Rowan was wanting to read it.
It's
wonderful. It's great. And it's different. And we watched the movie together, and we all had a wonderful time. It's meaningfully different. It is more commercially whatever viable, but it's still got that flavor. But I think Nimona would have been on the hot books of the month with an adaptation coming out. Killers of the Flower Moon's coming out, right? And that's different than the It books. And is that a thing? What is that? Why haven't I done that? And if should I have done it? Am I lazy? Am I stupid? What's my problem?
I am going to guess that the reason you haven't done it, or a reason you haven't done it, is that in most years, there are like a handful of books that are the It book for several months. Like what you're talking about is what should be the It books of the month. Like Blood Meridian should have, in our Court of Rightness, soared up the bestseller list when Cormac McCarthy died. It is right and proper, and I'm glad it happened, that Nimona is now very hard to find or impossible to find, because that is wonderful. I'm glad the adaptation is great. It should be talked about as an It book of the month. But like in reality, for the last, I don't know, 68 months, the It book of the month has been Atomic Habits and Something by Colleen Hoover, and then for a while, Where the Crawdads Sing. So there's the, I guess, how much do you want to editorialize that list is the primary factor for determining, is this a thing to do or not? Because what we think are the interesting books that like should be the conversations, or that are the conversations like in a very small circle of book media, is a totally different thing from the, you know, the hot books of the month out in the world of normies who read 10 to 12 books a year, which is, you know, the general reading public. And for those folks, there's not much movement there. It's not, it's often not very interesting. So that's my take.
I think you're right in a central guard, which is you need to, it's kind of like just replicating the New York or just the NPD book scan list. Cause you're not doing that. Cause that you get To Kill a Mockingbird is on there every May. You're going to get the places you'll go. So you have to apply some sort of New York Times bestseller, like, I don't know, heuristic or curation or put your thumb on the scale in one way or the other. Because I guess what I'm saying is I maybe this is a list that is trying to serve multiple purposes, and that could either kill it, or maybe you lean into that and say something like, you remember, I would do, and I should do this again. It's still a good piece of content and a fun discussion piece, especially since I'm not on Twitter as myself and no one can yell at me in a way that I care about anymore, of the old zero to well-read list I used to do.
Like, those are
if
fun.
You were an alien dropped out of the sky, or wherever aliens come from, maybe the deep sea. I don't go there either, but aliens can come from anywhere. I don't discriminate against your alien origin story. And they're like, you know what? I'd like to be well-read, and I've only got 100 books. These are weird constraints. Aliens that can only read 100 books, and they want this particular thing. But go with me here for a second. And that is not just the bestsellers, right?
Right.
And it's not only classics. You're trying to get a mix of the pillars of the earth stuff. You're going to have a Shakespeare, you're going to have a Jane Austen, you're going to have it. And, you know, they're going to be weighted differently. But you also want to be conversant to the literary cocktail party that doesn't exist, or at least that, you know, most of us don't ever go to, certainly not aliens from the deep sea when they haven't read all the books. They're worried about that cocktail party. They got to do the reading first.
I think
you have, you know, you want to be conversant in some of the more recent stuff.
I think that framing.
And so you weight it that way.
I think that framing is helpful for this idea of maybe not the hot books of the month, but the books to know about this month, the books to pay attention to. If you're trying to be a well-informed citizen of the book world, what are the things that you want to have read or at least be conversant about this month? And that is a moving target, because then you get this this author died, this author that maybe you haven't read before won the Nobel. And so now we're all going to go.
Hugo winners.
Right.
Pride those, month. This thing is.
Yes, I think that's a more useful framework for that, books to know about, than what was hot, because what's hot is often the same thing. But books to know about gives you a lot of hooks to hang an interesting conversation on. Not a bad, so you didn't start with a bad idea, but as often happens, we arrived at a better one together, I think.
Well, yeah, there's something, I think there's, and maybe it's something to play around with in some different kind of a format. I don't know what the right, because I like the idea, because I kind of like the idea that there are some that might be on there for a while. Because it would be hard to pull Lessons from Chemistry off right now. A, it's selling and there's adaptation coming.
Yeah.
But maybe after a year, you're like, it goes into the Hall of Fame or it gets emeritus status.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like, and okay, it could, this is just a part of the firmament, and it's no, because at that point it's no longer hot. That's right. Just being red.
And it could move up and down.
That's different. That's a different heuristic.
Yeah. If you had a ranked list each month of the books to know about, it could move up and down, and it would be interesting to say, you know, Lessons in Chemistry is still on the list, but now it's in the 8th spot. Last month it was at number 5. Here's why. And then you see it move back up into a high place when the adaptation comes out.
So I guess a bit of feedback request out there, podcast@bookriot.com. Is that interesting? Would that be an interesting piece of content for you to engage with at some point? And then I would welcome any iterations, spins, zhuzh, improvisations on top of that. I think it's probably the array I really imagined doing it. I even thought of at one point having like a button on the homepage. Remember when homepages mattered those days? Of like the Book Riot Hot 100. And you'd click on it and it would just be the list. And maybe there'd be a why. There'd be the list. There'd be the cover, maybe a synopsis and a why this is on the list right here. And it would change relatively frequently. I don't know what that looks like. Probably monthly would be the quickest you could do it. Because you don't want to do an update where there's no changes. Though if you did it weekly, maybe that's another way of covering new releases. Like, okay, this new release is entering. The Librarianist by Patrick DeWitt came out Tuesday. I still need to go down to Powell buy my copy. This week, it's going to knock something out for a week. Maybe that'll take its spot back in. But this week, it's hotter than, you know, the literary fiction novel that came out 3 weeks ago. Is A Living Remedy still on that list? When it drops out, when it drops down, maybe there's something to say about those.
Yeah, maybe there's a hybrid way of doing that. I like this general vibe.
And then you can talk about new releases or at least have a place to put new releases that endure for a little bit longer. Because one thing is, I haven't yet done a book Twitter check-in, and maybe I can segue into that here in a minute because I'm doing late night radio suddenly. is something comes out and it's talked about for Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. People are retweeting the reviews. Thank you so much. Here's my book. And then it's gone.
And then next Tuesday, it's a new cycle. Yeah.
It's a new cycle. And I think that some books should stay somewhere to put them. Because even our own coverage, like new books, it books, they move on. But like Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow still matters more right now than 99% of the new releases that have come out in the last couple months, because it's selling and people are talking about it and there's adaptation talk and there's a whole thing. You know, it was the Book Riot, not the Book Riot, but the Barnes & Noble Book of the Year, and there's adaptation. Then there was the Gabriel Zevin thing where one of the game designers was like, that's my board game took the idea from. Like, things can come and stay in the news for a little bit longer, and something other than just it's selling is worth doing, and maybe it's fun. And I'm always trying to figure a way to cover books like sports, some way to keep these books that authors work for years on, and then also take some time to read. And it's not like Indiana Jones coming out where a lot of people are going to see it opening weekend. The wick on these things burns longer. And this, how do you meet people where they are and try to keep something more centralized? I know it's an impossible task.
It is.
But just because it's impossible doesn't mean it's not fun or interesting to try.
Yeah, and it's one of the central problems of figuring out how to cover books, precisely because most people don't care about the new books that are coming out that Tuesday. And even if they do, they're not going to their bookstore every Tuesday, picking up that new release and reading it immediately in the way that if you're stoked about Indiana Jones or, I don't know, July 21st when Barbie and Oppenheimer come out on the same day, you're going to go.
Yeah, right?
You're going to go. Like, I'm going to have a Boppenheimer day. That's what I'm going to do. And
are you doing Boppenheimer?
I think we're going to do Boppenheimer.
Barbie first, dessert first?
I don't know. We haven't, Bob and I have not discussed the strategy for this. Okay. I got to do some careful planning about how I pitch this idea.
Oh, I see. Okay.
I'm going to do Boppenheimer.
Bob, that Barbie is actually about tall ships.
Barbie on Tall Ships is a crossover that I could sell the crap out of in this household. I think both really interesting movies and probably a more like one for me, one for you, but let's go do a double feature situation.
That's right.
But, you know, that's an event day. And there are a couple event days each year in publishing where October 3rd looks like one of those for us this year. We get, for you and me, we get Jesmyn Ward and Michael Lewis on the same day. But even that, we get paid to do this. And even that is pretty rare for us, where it's like, I've got to go buy this new book on its release day. That is the story. It does fall off after a week or two, or if it's lucky, it falls off after a week or two. Usually, as you were saying, the buzz falls off from new titles after a day or two, and then we're just on to the next week. And how to balance the way publishing publicizes and releases books with the way that readers actually encounter them and seek them out is the sort of perpetual challenge of this.
Yeah, because, you know, the other thing that happens, like, and I haven't followed the strict chronology of how, like, book clubs are picking it. I mean, like, the big one, the Reese's, of the GMA, because it's not a link in here because it's not worth talking about on its own accord, except in this context. Reese just picked Yellowface by Arf Kuang for the book club. That would have meant this week, if we're doing it weekly, that would jump up some notches.
And it's been out for a couple weeks, right? It's
there, a couple months. It was May.
That's right. Best I can tell, there's not a, like, standardized logic to internally to any of these book clubs. Like, sometimes the Oprah pick is a book that it's announced like the day the book comes out. Sometimes it's a couple weeks before the book comes out. Sometimes it's later because maybe she was late to finding out about that book and discovering she loved it. It seems that Reese does the same thing, which is great. Like, pick the books that you want to pick and highlight them and don't be contained or constrained by publishing's schedule. But I think they're even, the curators of the world's biggest book clubs are even struggling with this of, like, how much does publication date matter? And I mean, I think the headline is usually it matters a whole lot to publishers and not very much to readers, but how do you bridge that divide in coverage of books?
Yeah. So maybe we'll try something.
Yeah, let's do it.
We've got some new content things in the works for the fall. You know, it's nothing major, but there's some place, there's other places beside podcasting.
Got some ideas.
And this might be an interesting use case of that. Anyway, podcast@bookriot.com. Let me segue into book Twitter just for a second.
I'm so ready.
I mean, it's worth talking about because Threads came out yesterday, which is Facebook's using Instagram. How do you do this?
Meta's Instagram Twitter killer.
Right. So basically, Meta decided we have a robust social network that if we just turn on a Twitter-like experience and let people import their contacts, we could have a huge user base for text-based social network, right? Mm-hmm. And Twitter's been a gong show. I mean, is it a gong show if the gong is always being struck like 24 hours a day? Is that a gong show?
This is the like social network that cried wolf situation, because I haven't been on Twitter now for like many, many years. And every month there's like I see in my social feeds and the newsletters I read, like, well, this new thing Elon Musk did is the death of Twitter. Now Twitter's dead. But like those people all seem to be staying there because the next month they report on the death of Twitter yet again. Like maybe one of these days it will actually be the final straw. But it seems to me like folks are tolerating a lot more than they anticipated they would.
Yeah, I think people are mistaking the gong for the bell tolling.
That's right.
And I think that's what's been happening so far. But Instagram is a different beast. It's not Mastodon. It's not Blue Sky. It's not Spill or Hive or some of these other things that come along, because the thing about a social network is the network.
Yeah.
And a lot of these other places are trying to say, what if it were Twitter but not Twitter? And you need a lot of reason for people to switch over, because there's the thing about Twitter is not the technology. It's not the API. It's not the quote tweets. It's not the language. I don't even think it's really the code, though. That's easy for me to say, knowing nothing about it. It's the people there. Mm-hmm. That's what matters about any social network. Are there enough? Is there a critical mass of people there that it feels like it's alive and where you want to be? Because there's only so many social media parties.
Right.
And if you go to a party and it's dead, even if it's the exactly same music and food and mood or whatever, no one wants to go to that party. They want to go to the party where all the people are. And it didn't have to. It actually can be a worse experience if the party where all the people at, because people want to go to parties because we're the people. And these other places haven't been able to differentiate yourself enough other than say, well, we're Twitter but not Twitter. And what does that mean? And it's hard to get your following over there, and you got to log something in. Well,
you have to wait for an invite.
Oh God, forget about it. I think Blue Sky missed the boat.
I'm never waiting for an invite for a social platform ever.
But anyway, Instagram turned it on. It's a nice experience. I looked at it. It looks a lot like Twitter. You know, whatever. Is it? Does Instagram have enough of a following where from day one, a lot of people can move over there? I think more normies use Instagram than Twitter, which is interesting.
Oh, for sure. I think my biggest question about it is based on that like at its peak, less than 20% of the American population was on Twitter, and a much larger chunk of the U.S. population uses Facebook and Instagram. I don't know the exact numbers,
right,
but there is there's something very different about creating what's functionally just visual content, sharing photos and sharing, you know, memes and reels now on Instagram, and text-based communication, which is the, you know, only thing really you're doing on Twitter, or the primary thing, communicating in words. Do people, how much interest is there in doing that in a world that has pivoted so hard into video and TikTok and that kind of vibe? And how many people are actually good and interesting on it? Like, there was something about the size of Twitter and that it, like, Twitter drew a lot of media folks. Like, there was a lot of sort of commentary and interesting discussion that was happening on Twitter that I, my impression is that a lot of, like, the power users would say that one of the special things about Twitter was that everybody wasn't on it. It wasn't, yes, like your drunk uncle from Thanksgiving and your favorite New York Times reporter. Mm. There was a certain, like, rarefied air to moments of Twitter. Definitely not my impression of it anymore, but
yeah,
how much is it interesting? If it's definitely easier to use if you can just, if anybody can get on and you can import your contacts and do those things, but what does that do to the quality of the user experience in terms of the content, at least, is an open question for me.
Yeah, so my maybe ill-advised reentry into using Twitter has really been a discovery thing,
mm-hmm,
of like, I have a first edition account. You can follow it there. I'm not really posting anything right now because I'm terrified. Not terrified, but just like I'm not interested in building a following there. It's mostly, I'm usually mostly to find links and then ideas for interviews or what people are doing or content stuff. Like, it's basically, mm-hmm, like an RSS reader that individual people in account can do. But in following certain critics or book industry people, not only do I have to get their publishing stuff, I've got to get their takes, which I don't want, frankly. Mm-hmm. And the dynamic I seem to have walked into, and I'm not this sure if this is everyone's feed or if it's just mine, is that there's kind of a dynamic that's really unpleasant and I want no part of it. Maybe this even represents a change in my own thinking, which is to have a take on anything that starts to get traction as part of the quote-unquote discourse. You have to, mm-hmm, have a take on it. And then what happens is a snowball effect. So there, I think I mentioned a couple of these in prior episodes. There was something that went around over the last couple of days. Someone with 4,000 followers, which is really nothing in the, yeah, grand scheme of things, and who knows if they're real or followbacks or, you know, no way to know, had a take that was something like, if you're reading in public, that's performative. Don't
oh, Lord,
act. Which, okay, I don't agree with that. Who cares? But then it became fun. It became sport-taking,
mm-hmm,
to have quote tweet it and say, this is dumb. Or, you know, this tweet is performative. And then that gets traction. Then
your
other people,
mom is performative.
Come on. Yeah, your mom is performative. Performance is performative. Which is the depth of the irony of this happening on Twitter is just mind-boggling in a way that the Emperor Has No Takes show title. I have come around to this, which is there was a time in which it felt important to critique in the name of truth and rightness things you saw as being away from the light, whatever you want to say, to, mm-hmm, use the Murakami, the egg in the wall, on,
right,
the side of the egg, be on the side of the egg at all times. I have come around to sometimes it's okay if someone says has a dumb thought or a dumb opinion. That's different than being a bad person.
That's the
different
important
than being,
piece, yeah.
Or riding a horse for so long, or, like, you know, to use She Who Will Not Be Named, that's the example that I think I'm still okay with people, mm-hmm, dunking. Now, or being consistently critical of her championing of a certain point of view. And I don't even want to talk about the specifics because I know,
yeah,
people find it upsetting, as I do, and it's beyond. That's different than someone saying, I think reading a book is performative. It just is.
It just is.
It just, yeah, is different. And it's a dumb take. Don't get me wrong. It's a dumb take.
Well,
but which one do you want to be? The person making one dumb take, or the person, the kinds of people, the kinds of community that relentlessly finds the weakest wildebeest in the herd and then sends all the lions after it?
It doesn't encourage positive discourse or useful discourse. That kind of behavior has a chilling effect on the conversations that are the moments that we point to when we point to ways that social media has been good. Like when there is major injustice and there is a way for people to collectively come together and either find each other on social media and amplify a message or plan a protest or, you know, make a stand in a way that is really big and powerful. That's a thing that we couldn't do in that way prior to having Facebook and Twitter in the world where the whole world was connected, or you could plug into that if you wanted to. But when you treat everything as signal and as an equal, like equally important and equal kind of signal, it flattens the impact of response when there is a major injustice, when someone is really in the wrong and there is not just a bad take, but a harmful take to call out. If dumb takes are treated the same as dangerous takes, that means dangerous takes are treated the same as dumb takes. And how do you differentiate between them? And how do you, you know, have it make an impact when you are trying to call out something that really is harmful or that really does need to have attention called to it? Like the performative nature of all of that and what it does to the people participating in it is something that I think we're going to think about a lot over the next couple of decades. I'd like to see some, you know, sociologists sort of dig into that. Like, what does this do to the folks who are terminally online? If you're existing in that way, what is your real life like? And how do you try to engage in a productive discourse? Like, I mean, I left Twitter right after the 2016 election because there was there was nothing fruitful about the experience of being there. Like the things that I saw that were bad were the same things that everyone else was seeing that were bad. And it felt like it was becoming a competition on who could prove that. No, they really did know that it was bad out there. And it's like, I don't need you to tell me. I know that those things are bad. When it's about that, rather than actually like furthering a conversation or doing something new, it's just... That's a bummer. I'm bummed that it went that way. I think last week we talked about Cory Doctorow's term about like the shitification of social networks. Yes. And I mean, we saw it on Facebook. You see it in a bunch of places. It's unfortunate that this seems to be the thing that people want to do when given a way to critique other people flatten that. It just flattens the discourse in a way that I find really disappointing and unhelpful.
So... And I guess I've come around to, and again, it's hard to author, especially if there's a particular group that's being harmed or, you know, denigrated. That's a different conversation. Mm-hmm. But you could have weird idiosyncratic ideas and dumb ideas, and that just aren't worth the conversation. And I think the worm, and this, I remember the days when this would be fun.
Yeah.
Or this was felt like fun, or it felt like... resistance of some kind, right? And who knows who this person is? Who knows who any of these people are that suddenly, for whatever reason, start to take the heat? Or this particular discourse that flares up? And there's been disagreements and nasty arguments to the dawn of time. I'm sure at the Agora, some people were playing dirty pool with their sophistry in the Hellenic world. But it's a little different when everyone can see you have a bad idea. And then everyone also tells you have a bad idea. And the punishment so outweighs the crime. And people mistake virtue for vice. And you're in a mundus inversus, the world upside down. That I don't know what any of these... I'm going to bring it back to Twitter competitors. I don't know what of those dynamics can be solved by someone just saying, this is Twitter without Elon Musk's stink on it. Because that dynamic is not going away.
No.
I don't think that's something that's been created by technology. I think it's something that's been enabled and enhanced by it. But I think there is a rush to judgment, a rush to have an opinion. Just read the comments to all the ethicist columns in the New York Times. It's always find interesting to read Appiah's takes. But everyone knows. Here's the nice thing about everyone: they all know what the right thing is. Congratulations to everyone. You've all got it figured out. You all behave perfectly at all times. You've got it all figured out, and there's no questions, and you never make mistakes. I wish those people, you know, they ran for office and stuff. It'd be nice to see them out there in the public. So I'm of the opinion of let it go. Mm-hmm. Let the bad takes go. If it is a bad, you know, is it a snapshot or a story? If it's someone that's in power that's telling a bad story, a harmful story over time, then maybe it's time to saddle up or think about how you can be a part of something. But boy, I think the bar for denigration, insult, mockery, you know, should be much higher in much people's
I think it's just that core kind of golden rule of the internet, or what should be the golden rule of the internet, of like, don't treat people online in a way that you wouldn't treat them to their faces. And, you know, having a dumb take is a thing people do when they're standing around at parties or you're at a backyard barbecue and somebody's got like a kind of dumb idea about a thing. And the proportional response, the appropriate response to that is maybe like gentle ribbing or like, oh, I don't know.
Come on.
Right. For real. You know, right. That indicates, all right, maybe that idea is not great, or somebody might, you know, well, have you thought about this thing with that? There's like an appropriate way to push back. In the same way that when your drunk uncle is spouting racist stuff at Thanksgiving, there's an appropriate way to push back on that. And pushing back on it is appropriate. But this like jumping on somebody who has a dumb take and basically like you're at a party, but you drag them into your circle. And now you tell everyone, you know, hey, I was at this thing and here's Jeff that I met at this other party. And this is his bad take. And I'd like to drag him into this room so you can all make fun of him. Now, this is not a way that it's just not a way that humans should behave with each other, especially if we're talking about trying to make the world better in some way. And to think that it's okay to do it because online is like, quote unquote, not real to us, when now we've had the internet long enough to know that it is real. The ways that we treat each other there, the things that we do and the things that we say have real world impact. I just think it's irresponsible. And there's something very self-serving, evidently self-serving about it, and not something that is the best use of any of our time when it's that way, when it can be used to elevate an important message or elevate an injustice that needs attention paid to it. Wonderful. Yes, let's do it. But this, you know, like the piling on and then performing so that everyone who follows you, you can make sure they know that you don't agree with that bad take. This like sort of constant construction of the way you wish to be perceived is, I don't know, I have very little patience for it these days. Can someone make us a social network that's built around like, what are the questions you're trying to live inside right now? I want more questions and less like,
how about
definitive.
This? I feel like there's O'Neill's razor, right? I think we need the Oats amnesty. Joyce Carol Oates would be the biggest beneficiary of this.
Yes.
'Cause I think at her core, she's okay, right? She on the core, she's okay.
She's just unfortunate on the internet.
She will blast off a real head scratcher every now and again. She will let one fly, and she tends not to have a hobby horse, right? This is not a rolling situation. It's like, well, this seems to me to be X. It's much more of a, I think the party comment is a really good example of it. Now, maybe if you're, you know, a famous author with hundreds of thousand people, maybe you know what you're doing when you do this, or maybe you should, I don't know. But my sense of Oates changes dramatically when I think of her as trying stuff out and having a stray thought. Then this is sort of like Russian disinformation or something, like, or this is some sort of planned strategy by a nefarious take mastermind to give me the mind virus.
And that is, I think that's helpful for you to phrase it that way, because that's what Twitter felt like in the earlier days, was a people kicking ideas around and sort of riffing on things and coming up with stuff. And there was this creative, iterative space that it doesn't seem like there's any room for there, because like the way to get to a new, interesting, creative thing is to try a bunch of bad ideas along the way. You know, like it's not just the first pancake. It's probably like the first 20. And if you can't have a harmless bad idea in public, you can't collaborate in public. You can't create in public. And having folks react to a harmless bad idea in the same way that they react to harmful bad ideas doesn't get us anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe there's a button, you know, because right now you can retweet, comment, heart. You need a comment for a settle down button for someone else's take.
For a chill.
So it's not the original thing. There's a, you know, quote tweeting, can you believe this MF-er, right? That's, mm-hmm. you know, of something harmless or harmless. Most of the time you're like, yeah, that's a stupid thing to say, or that seems screwed up or whatever. But when they're the 900th person to pile on, a chill out button
yeah.
would be very helpful. Well, or like, you know what? Enough already.
That was...
I get it. We all get it. We all get it. There's no, you're not adding a single whit of additional crap here.
Yeah. And that if that button existed and people would respect it, that would be magical. That was one of the things yeah. that I thought RF Kuang really nailed in Yellowface was that yes. once this kind of thing starts happening, like once the storm is going, there will be people who step in and try to be reasonable or try to like redirect whatever the community mm-hmm. is and be like, all right, y'all, like, I think they got the point. This is getting out of hand. Do we really want to behave that way? But what actually happens is then that person becomes the object of the pylon.
Yeah, look at Mr. Socrates right. coming in to right. tell us all how to think.
Right. You want to tell me to calm down?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, it must be nice to be able to calm down.
right. Which is very close to that thing that happened on Twitter, like, I think last year now, where a woman just tried to tweet, like, here's a photo of me and my husband having coffee in our garden. It's one of my favorite moments of the day. Every morning. And she got blasted by people. It was like, how privileged that you have a yard and a husband and coffee. How dare you enjoy it or tell anyone you enjoy it? Like, her day, her month, maybe like she probably feels like a good chunk of her life got ruined by that harassment over like I was just trying to share a thing. And if you had stepped into that to be like whoa everybody, then you become like the defender of the one that everyone's coming down on, so now you're in the bad camp too.
Yeah,
it's an impossible game to win.
It's impossible, and I don't know why I'm thinking about it so much. I guess having been away for so long, and now I've been like messing around observing. I mean, frankly, just observing for yeah. a few months and then posting a first edition link every now and again, just to have something there to people to point to. It's like, I feel like it's like Gulliver's Travel, where you walk into this different land and the currency is the opinion or judgment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that becomes the coin of the realm. And it just is not an interesting way for me to operate anymore. And it's, I think if you've been on there a long time and you participate in this economy, you don't even get that that's the water you're swimming
right.
around in. Like, you don't even understand how strange and how sociopathic in some ways some of the normalized behaviors mm-hmm. in. And it's a slippery slope. Or it's not even a slippery slope. It's like a death by a thousand cuts. Yeah. Like, because you're probably, all your takes, if you're on their book Twitter all day, or any sort of hashtag X, Twitter for X, right, a subcommunity or interest, any individual one of your takes onto the hurricane of the day is probably, by the court of rightness, would be approved.
Yeah.
Right? Your individual opinion of that thing. But there's something about the whole being greater than the sum of its parts when it comes to so many, so quickly, so vociferously. So I don't know. I'll continue to use it, but I mute people and I unfollow people that seem to get more pleasure out of the sport twittering than the contribute twittering, which is helpful. But I don't know. Which makes me less excited about any given Twitter replacement, because I think that social dynamics are going to port over.
I think that's right. Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Let's do our second sponsor. Maybe we'll actually talk about real stories. What do you think? Rather than me just
saying maybe some books
and asking you to talk with me about them.
Today's episode is brought to you by Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang. So this is an interesting love story. It's great for fans of Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow and High Fidelity. It's set in the mid-90s at NYU. And it follows young Wang, who has gotten the advice of love through Chinese numerology from his uncle. So he believes that he will have 7 great loves in his life. And then he meets Irena in 95. And she's like the best. She's brilliant, charismatic, quick-witted, funny. They fall in love,
But the thing is, she's number six. So if he is to have seven great loves, does that mean his time with Irina is going to come to an end? So this is a love letter to Western pop culture, Eastern traditions, and being a first generation New Yorker. Make sure to check it out. And thanks again to Flatiron Books, publisher of 888 Love and the Divine Burden of Numbers by Abraham Chang, for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour. HeroQuest is a graphic novel that is the story of a genetically augmented metahuman named Hero who travels into the multiverse 400 years into the future to save Earth from a disaster it cannot avoid. It has everything from mutants to robots to zombies to aliens, witches, and more. It's a quest for 10 rings of tremendous power from 10 different worlds that will be needed to save our world from certain disaster. It's an epic journey that will require the hero named Hiro to be cursed to save the lives of billions on Earth. It's a story of heroism, wonder, betrayal, and finally, revelation. This is the hero's journey. This is Hiro's quest. So the story was imagined by the mind of Steve Aoki and written by New York Times bestselling author Jim Kruger and Steve Aoki. So make sure to check it out. And this episode comes thanks again to Steve Aoki's HeroQuest at your local bookstore or online at HeroQuest.com, and catch Steve live on the Heavenly Hell Tour.
Let's see. I guess two news pieces. We'll put a link in here about some more stuff about Amazon and Goodreads. I think for those of you who want to follow up on that, we'll find a link, shownotesbookriot.com/listen. We talked about TikTok, ByteDance being the parent company. We mentioned that they were hiring. I think we saw some, read some early tea leaves that this is happening, but it's official now because the New York Times is covering it. And I'm not the person that says that snarkily.
No.
Like, look, the New York Times is on it. I think the New York Times is, like all human institutions, flawed. But there ain't no many places like the New York Times, so I try to appreciate them, and because there is no substitute. But they got the full work up there. You know, I don't know. Are they going to put the finger on the scale? That's the single question to me. And if they're not, why are they doing this? So those are the two questions to me, Rebecca. Coming out of this article, is there anything else you wanted to note from this piece?
They seem to be. It seems that, at least from the folks that the reporters for The Times are able to speak to, ByteDance seems to be really counting on the appeal of, you will be connected to TikTok. You will have a lot of publicity access, because they talked to some authors that got offers from ByteDance, including a romance author named Trisha O'Malley. She's published about 40 books. Her deal from ByteDance, they offered to buy the rights to two of her books. The deal included a social media marketing campaign, royalties, and an advance of $3,500 per book. $3,500, which is an incredibly small advance. She notes that that's less than her titles earn every month currently. So if ByteDance is trying to compete with the $50,000, $100,000 kind of deals that authors pretty frequently receive for works of fiction, or, you know, more than that for something that a publisher anticipates is going to be a big seller, especially in genre fiction, they're really banking, like literally banking on the impact of the social media stuff and the, like, the not even implied, but just barely not stated promise that TikTok will help you sell, will sell books for you.
Like, that's barely implied. Was I was going to like, just say it.
Yeah.
What are the value proposition other
which
than that?
I think means they have to be planning to put their thumbs on the
they
scale.
Have to.
Because other, like, we know there's only a handful of things that have been what the public, we perceive to be organic sensations that really became bestsellers. And we also know that TikTok can put their thumb on the scale and does put their thumb on the scale for some kinds of content. So we don't know if, like, some of the Colleen Hoover stuff was eventually ByteDance putting their thumb on the scale to further it. We don't know for any of those authors. They're never going to tell us. But if they're saying, we're going to give you an advance of $3,500, that's it, to write a book, they're implying here, you're going to sell a whole lot of books and that's going to make up and maybe extend right. beyond that gap between this $3,500 advance and the tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars advance that is typical in publishing. And the only way that they can deliver on that promise for a bunch of authors is to put their thumb on the scale.
And I don't understand why cheap out on the advance. It reminds me of that scene in Jurassic Park where like he's, you know, he has the lunch and he's like getting ready to right. get millions of dollars for the embryos, and the dude isn't going to pick up the check for like yeah. the whatever, you know,
right.
the $4 tacos. Like, don't get cheap on me now. If you're going to do this, why not offer an advance that's competitive, take it, and then sell the crap out of it,
mm-hmm.
and then. For the next one, say, you know what? We actually don't do advances because
right.
we just sell books.
I think you
we don't
gotta,
need to do advances.
You got to start with, or it would be wise to start with, a deal that looks pretty similar to traditional publishing deals and right. has the gravy of, and we're TikTok. And then let yes. those results speak for themselves. And when those authors have an amazing experience, let them become publicity for you so that other authors want to go to ByteDance Publishing rather than, you know, PRH or Simon & Schuster or wherever. But this is a huge risk to take, and unless for an author, and unless ByteDance is telling them, we're going to put our thumb on the scale to the tune of book sales that we can functionally promise you are going to make you money equivalent to what you would make with a traditional mm-hmm. publisher. I don't know why an author would take that deal. Unless there's details being disclosed to these authors that are not being disclosed publicly.
I'm trying to think. Maybe TikTok isn't sure it can move units.
Yeah,
because has it done like anything before? Mm-hmm. Does it know for sure that it could sell 50,000 copies of a paper trade paperback?
We don't know. Like,
yeah. Well, do they know? That's
yeah.
what I'm saying. Do you think they know?
I think it's possible. Like, I would believe that they might be able to trot data out and say, this one book that became a TikTok sensation, we just liked that content. We put our thumb on the scale. Here's where it surged. It's us TikTok that made it a bestseller. It wasn't an organic thing. But do they want to admit that at this point? Because now there's been 2 years of, you know, just like breathless media coverage of the magic yeah. of TikTok word of mouth. And if TikTok comes out and reveals which word of mouth sensations were not actually word of mouth sensations, but were TikTok weighting the algorithm in favor of particular things, that cuts down on the appeal of just being there as yeah. a user.
Because if it doesn't work, don't you question the whole like TikTok advertising
yes,
model itself?
All of
like
it.
If TikTok can't even do it to yourself, why should I pay for ads?
Right.
On TikTok?
If they can't successfully sell books with the access yeah. to the algorithm and the ability right. to put their thumbs on the scale, why should we believe they can successfully sell anything? Yeah.
Yeah. We'll mention one story, then we got to get moving here. A group of authors, I guess two authors, Mona Awad and Paul Tremblay, joining together to sue ChatGPT. I'm sorry, OpenAI. ChatGPT is a school, the tool, OpenAI is a company, claiming that, quote, the organization breached copyright law by training its models on novels without the permission of the authors, is a piece in The Guardian by Ella Creamer. I need to get a copyright lawyer in a group chat or something, because I don't get it. I mean, no, I'm not saying yes or no. Like, how do you know this? How do you prove it? This is stuff in the public. It's not plagiarizing it really in the way that we understand. I'll be fascinated to watch this unfold.
Yeah.
So I don't have anything to say here except interesting.
I feel like I have one eyebrow raised in each direction of this.
Mm.
Because the reasoning that they're giving for this is for believing that ChatGPT ingested their text is that ChatGPT can generate a, quote, very accurate summary of each novel. And so it seems these authors believe that the only way ChatGPT could generate a very accurate summary of the novel is if they've read the novel. And that seems to me to reveal a fundamental misunderstanding of how ChatGPT works or how any of these large language models work, because ChatGPT has ingested every summary of that book that's publicly available on the internet.
All the reviews, all the tweets about
right,
it.
Right, all the synopses.
The Wikipedia page,
right.
Their author pages,
yeah,
the publisher pages.
It doesn't need to have read the book, because it's read everything that the internet has written about the book, and that's how it arrives there. And so, like, that raised my eyebrow for, like, are we really, like, okay, if you're the copyright attorney, this is probably very interesting, and also maybe you're making some money just pursuing this, but unless there are details about this that didn't make its way into this Guardian piece, I think these authors look a little ignorant about how the tool functions. And so I'll be interested. Yeah. I'm really interested to see in what other details come out as this plays out. Does it even survive long enough to, like, go anywhere in court?
I have no idea.
Yeah. I was trying to extrapolate, like, you know, we've talked about, like, using it for recipes, and just, like, the fact that ChatGPT can tell me how to make a roast chicken doesn't mean that it read Ina Garten's cookbook against her will. You know, it just means there are, like, a floppity jillion roast chicken recipes, and they're all pretty similar to each other. And if it looks like the one in your cookbook, it doesn't mean that, or if it can summarize how to do that thing that you also know how to do, if it's all over the internet, that's all ChatGPT needs. It doesn't need direct access to the original text. And I've, you know,
I guess it's possible someone was sitting there with a scanner or a Kindle book fed it into the machine.
Maybe.
No understanding how this works.
Like, I've asked it to summarize some of the things that I've read over the last couple of months just to see, or like when we were doing White Noise on for the bonus episodes, I was like, I wonder what ChatGPT will get from, like, 20 years worth of internet talking about, you know, White Noise. And it did a pretty good job. And I don't think that's because it had read the book itself. Like, that also gives ChatGPT credit in a place it's not due. It can't synthesize information. It can't make sense of a bunch of ideas and pull them together.
No.
It can only take text it has access to and recombine it into, you know, quote unquote, original sentences. So
Says, OpenAI says that ChatGPT was trained on a data set of internet-based books called Books 2, is what they call the database. Mm-hmm. The lawyers deduced that the size of this data set, estimated to contain 294,000 titles, means the books could only be drawn from shadow libraries, so basically pirated internet stuff. And I guess that's, you know, stuff that shouldn't be available. Maybe that's true. I don't know.
I mean,
there certainly could be 294,000 public domain books.
Yeah, I think it's
there could be easily in out there on the internet.
Totally,
that,
and
don't
it's,
violate copyright.
And it's totally possible that multiple things happened here. Like, it's possible that ChatGPT did ingest the text of these books. I believe that even if that happened and you removed the text of these books from ChatGPT's training, it would still be able to provide a very accurate summary of these books, because there are very accurate summaries of these books all over the internet. So, like, whether it makes a material difference is a different question from did it ingest something it shouldn't have.
The discovery of this alone will be fascinating if it gets that far. I mean, the question you're sort of suggesting, if what you're saying is more true, and I think I agree with you, the person who might have a better case is like a Ron Charles, who maybe wrote a review of Mona Wad's book, right? And if the fundamental question is, are these the right people, is it not the most interesting question to bring a suit? The more interesting question is there a suit to be brought against OpenAI for using the words that are publicly available as the raw material to generate. I love this verb, generate. Maybe it should be the word of the year, Frank. I'm not kidding.
I think that's right.
Generate, because it's kind of weirdly indeterminate. It's not creative. It's not making it generate this text. Is that a violation of copyright? Has it done something outside of our, forget for the moment, moral, ethical? Because that's a different standard. Our legal understanding of what copyright is. And I'm not sure that it is. I'm just not sure either way. So, looking forward to that. The last thing, let's hold off on Frontless Foyer.
Yeah.
Keep the people waiting. I got a couple of things to talk about, but I'll have them done by next time so I can speak about them. Show notes, bookriot.com/listen. Shoot me an email about the Book Riot Hot 100 idea. If you've got a good idea, a version, does someone do something like that? Also, if you've seen other platforms do this for music or movies or birds, what are the hot birds in your neighborhood? I'm reading Better Living Through Birding. That's a whole thing. You know, you get an alert that there's a warbler down the block and you got to run out there
in
your underwear. Because at home, I guess that means to suggest that you're just in your underwear always at home.
A hilarious example coming out of your particular person.
Yeah, no, that's not. You know, I'm wearing a three-piece suit right now, top, head, and tails, like a gentleman. Shoot us email there. Check out the Patreon. Check out First Edition. Rebecca, we'll talk to you next time.
Have a good one.